Oh, my Tay is yelling from the other computer that she can. So yay. Art Blakey, we've known each other for so many years, and our relationship, which I like to think of as friendly, is based on making fun of each other. That's how we show affection to each other. Every now and then, I like to say something nice about him to throw him off his game and make him wonder if I'm what I'm up to. But thank you so much for your special music. And besides singing better than the rest of the congregation combined, Tay and I have always been aware that Art takes great care in choosing the songs that he gives to us. And man, the man looks good too, doesn't he? He always does. Anyway, thank you very much, Art, for the treat on more than one level. Really appreciate that. You get to see me. I don't get to see you. It seems like punishment both directions, but that's just the way that it is. And thank you very much for the gentleman in the back who make this work. I really appreciate that. It's such a luxury. And if we had tried to tell people about it 1,000 years ago, they wouldn't have believed it was possible. But it's a wonderful thing. Some of you, there are actually people who are listening to this today who will remember a woman whom I'm going to mention. She was from the Cleveland West congregation, and a number of the old timers in our church family are from the Cleveland West family. We came into it in the 70s. We moved here, and we had some personal tragedies in our life at that point, and the Cleveland West Church took us in and gave us a safe home and made us part of the gang, and we always appreciated that, and we've never forgotten it. To this day, it's been an important part of our Cleveland church life, and we always remember it. But there was a woman in the church named Laverne Whiting, and Laverne was one of the older ladies, and she was smart and she was opinionated. She was very dedicated to God's way of life. She and her sister, Marge, Marge married Lou Baker, who many of you will remember. It was the wedding of the century. I mean, they were both senior citizens, and the church went all out, and it was a wonderful thing. But Laverne Whiting was our church poet laureate, among other things. She wrote lots and lots of poetry. You couldn't stop her from writing poetry. Now, there were some people who said she didn't write poetry, she wrote doggerel. And doggerel is what's inside greeting cards, you know, that goes da 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 da. And actually, that was the way that Laverne's poetry scanned, but it was fun and it was funny. And she was well known for it. We were not to call her a poetess. She was a poet, so she was firm on that. And I remember at one point I was working for a church member named Dan Abbott at that point. And one night, Miss Whiting was not at home and her trailer burned down. And it was a big tragedy for her. She lost all kinds of things, pretty much everything. She had insurance, but one thing she didn't have was people to help her clean up. So I was one of the people, and there were quite a number. That's the way Cleveland West was. And Dan was there with his vehicle. Al Patchinger was there, and other people. And we pitched in and we helped clean up Miss Whiting's trailer. And I was new to the family, and she had her eye on me as a possible problem because I was a young yahoo. I mean, I like to treat people with respect, but I like to have fun with people too, including Miss Whiting, because she was a bright person, and you could spar with her. She was sometimes a worthy adversary. So after her trailer burned, I wrote her a poem, and I do believe it was the last poem I wrote, but I thought it was fitting because she wrote poems for all of us to commemorate almost everything. As a matter of fact, it wasn't a church event unless Laverne Whiting wrote a poem about it. And I have some of her poems still, but I wrote her a poem because I thought it was called for to commemorate the event. And I should like to recite it for you today. The poem goes like this, and it's in Miss Whiting's rhythm. Miss Whiting is a poet. She writes all kinds of stuff. Some is pretty witty, and some is somewhat rough. I'm glad that when her trailer burned, Miss Whiting wasn't there. She did not see her poetry burn up into the air. Still, it gives my heart a lift to know that at least a small degree of the air that I am breathing is Miss Whiting's poetry. I thought that was a Herculean effort. She hated it. And as I expected her to, that was part of the deal, I think. But we were friends, and I still remember cleaning up her her burnt things, and she was getting all new stuff. So in some ways it was a treat for her because she was starting over with good things and she had people to help her out. But I remember Tay and I didn't have much in those days. We were renting a house in Elyria on East Avenue, and we didn't have much. And there was a lamp. I think Tay had said that we needed a lamp. There was a lamp that I was carrying out to the junk pile because it was charred black. It would no longer work. The wiring was all burnt up. And I said, could I have this lamp? And she said, well, how much are you willing to pay for it? And I thought, oh, okay. So I checked my wallet. I had $3. And I said, I'll give you $3 for it, which to me was $3 more than it was worth. And Miss Whiting said, the lamp is worth a lot more than that. But she sighed and hemmed and hawed and eventually gave me the lamp for $3. Well, I took it home and Taya sanded it down and painted it, and we bought a new lampshade. I rewired it, and it became part of our household. And I still have this lamp. It's here today. It used to sit in our living room next to the couch. Now it's in a back bedroom, but it's nice because it has this table on it. And this lamp, when we moved to our Lakewood house, this lamp became my Friday night lamp. There's something that we have that a lot of the rest of the world doesn't have. There are some other groups who have it, and that's Friday nights. They don't know the joy of Friday night, particularly in the winter when it starts early, because we come from a hard week. We've gone through 6 days, shall you work? We've done our part, and we've put up with all the things that the world can drag us through. And then Friday night is a time for special meals and candles and hiding from the world and going into a place where we're safe and apart from things. And it's a sanctuary and a respite. It's whether it's a physical one or not. Spiritually, that's what it is for us. And I had my lamp, and I ended up with my Friday night, I don't know what you would call it, ceremony, I'm not sure. Taya would often go to bed early meaning like 9 o'clock or so, because she'd be tired. And we had two children and they would often be in bed. And I would go to the corner of the couch by this lamp, and I had certain things there. I had the lamp, of course. I had my quilt, which was made for me on my 50th birthday. So this dates after that, by Mrs. Thomas and Renee Williams and Linda Warzycki. And I treasure this quilt. Taya makes quilts, but before she made quilts, the ladies gave me this. And it's, number one, it's huge. Number two, the material on it is things that I like, and I treasure this. But it was also part of my shutting out the world on Friday nights. I would sit there, and when I had everything the way that I wanted it, I would put the quilt over my head, and it was big enough that I could do that, and it was a great way to shut out the world. I had my mug from the Cleveland Metro Parks. It was part of the deal, and I always had some plant. Today we've got this orange orchid blooming. It was whatever was in bloom at the time, and I would put it on the lamp. The lamp got quite full, as you can imagine. I had my little pot that has things in it, like my earbuds and this and that, things that I might want. I would I sometimes would have a cookie, or if Taya had made pumpkin bread or something, I would have a slice of that. I had, so this would be after 2010, I had an iPad. Now this iPad that you're looking at may look to you like an ordinary iPad, but this iPad was purchased the second that iPads came onto the market. I was probably the first one of any of you to have an iPad, because I've been looking forward to it for a long time, because, and this still works, but one of the things that I was looking forward to with iPads was that they are absolutely fantastic for displaying music. I don't know if you can see that, but instead of carrying around 30 books to play for the singers that I played for, I could have it all on this iPad. And it still works, as I said. I've replaced it with an even bigger one now, and you can only update it so long. But you know, I had music on here, I had photos, I had a movie or two even. You know, I could access the internet, although that wasn't such a big part of life back then. Oh, let's put it this way, it was before I was addicted, I guess. But it was nice to have. And there were the comforts of Friday night that I could enjoy and enjoy God's way of life and do it better with an iPad. So that was part of it. I was very proud of that. Of course, I had a Bible, as we all would at that point. And I was quite content. And it was an old house. It was built in 1908. It was right across the street from where Sherry Agapitus and Dalton live now. And it's still across the street. We're just not there. But the thing about old houses is things fall off them with regularity. You'll just be sitting there and you'll hear a noise and something is going to cost you money again. There's always work to be done. And it was one of the things to hide from on a Friday night was your house. I don't feel that way about the two houses we've lived in since then. But back then, you know, I had my dark little corner because I didn't want to always see the rest of the house at that point, because the house was always things that I had to do. So I would sit there and I would read my Bible and I would listen to some music and enjoy my cup of coffee and whatever goodie was there. And I would pull my quilt over my head and I would think. Sometimes I would think with my eyes closed, I mean, because the quilt was over my head, which is a euphemism we have for napping, but often I would just think, and I was on the verge, of course, on Friday night of falling asleep in any given moment, so my thoughts would sometimes go into daydreams, and I had a particular, well, of course, it was night, so night dreams, I guess, and there was one that I ended up in over and over again. And I was in a spaceship. I don't know why, but I think because it symbolized to me being closed off. I was probably at the end of my life. I'd done everything I could do. And I was in a spaceship on my way somewhere. And of course there's nothing close by other than the moon. So I was going to be in that spaceship for a long time, but I could look out the window at stars, and I had my Bible and I had my iPad. I also, inexplicably also had very good Wi-Fi the entire time I was in the spaceship. I don't try to understand everything. Taya and the kids weren't there. I don't know what that says, but maybe I was being kind to them. And it just sort of symbolized to me being away from the world. And it was refreshing to me. I mean, there must have been some inner need that I had. And I would find myself going back to this. I think actually it was based in some fantasies I had when I was a child, and what isn't, you know, in our lives, you learn that about yourself. Nowadays, I find that I don't need it so much. Some things have changed. But of course, you know, life right now is closer to being that spaceship than it's been for a long time, because as you can see today, I'm in my house speaking to you. Taya and I have decided that we're going to be home for a lot of this COVID pandemic. And it's we're very careful when we go out. I do work, but I wear masks all the time. And the nice thing about piano tuning, I've mentioned before, is that people don't want to be near you when you're tuning piano. So it works out very well. And I wash my hands a lot. And but, you know, life is kind of dull in this safe place right now. And As much as I appreciate the safety, I also look forward to the time when we can bust out of it a little bit. But I find myself thinking about safe places a lot and how many of them God has given to us. I mean, you could say that the whole universe that he created to give his creation a place to be and all of mankind, you could say that the whole universe is a safe place, that we're protected from the rest of the spiritual world in many ways. Much of that cannot enter or interfere with our world. So he wanted a cradle to grow his family. And of course, you could say that the earth is a protected place. When you look at the whole universe, the earth is a safe place. There may be strange and awful things happening on the surface of it, thanks to people, or thanks to natural events that are cataclysmic. But it protects us from the rest of the universe. Our atmosphere protects us from radiation. Our atmosphere, you know, keeps us warm. Of course, we're cold right now, but in general, you know, the earth is warm enough to have liquid water that's very important for life. And it's a place where life can live. We haven't found any place for certain in the rest of the universe where life can exist. So this seems to be it. This is the safe place that God has given us, apart and protected from the rest of the universe. You could say, well, not just say, it's true. When God made Adam and Eve, after there was part of his creation before that, but when he made Adam and Eve, he put them in what was definitely a safe place, a protected place. We call it the Garden of Eden, but it was a place where they were protected from a lot of the cares of the world, not all of them, but many of them. It was meant to give them a nursery to grow up in. You know, they were adults physically, but they were children mentally. They were learning how to be alive, and God gave them a protected place. Throughout much of the story of God and his people and the way that he's interacted with us all, there's so many little pockets of safety, not just little ones. Noah's Ark is, of course, one of the big ones. Noah's Ark is such a wonderful story. And when you think about it, it's a horrible story. I mean, if you tell it from the point of view of the people and animals that died, it's not a nice story at all. And yet it's a story that we comfort our children with and that we think of many times on our own as God protecting us, because Noah went into first of all, he built a safe place. He was given instructions, and he brought animals into it. And of course, anytime you bring animals into the equation, people find it nice and warm and fuzzy. It's a good story. But there are so many books. I wonder how much of our economy is driven by Noah's Ark, movies and toys and books and stuffed animals. And anyway, it's a story that is so appealing to us as human beings, that even outside the world that views it as a story that has to do with God and his people, people know the story. It's a universal story. It's something you just say Noah and people know what you're talking about at that point. He took his people, Israel, when they were suffering, down to Egypt. And that was a safe place for them for a while. And at one point, there were problems, and he told them to paint their lintels with blood, which was the Passover, the historical Passover, and people found safety in that. They could retreat to their houses, and with the lamb's blood painted on their lintels, they were safe. It was a safe place where they could be apart from the world and hide. The promised land was a safe place, and God talks about that quite a bit when you come into the land, how I'm going to protect you. One of my favorite places, a safe place in the Bible that I like to read about, just the story, is in 1 Samuel, and I think it's chapter 20. And you're thinking, why didn't he look this up beforehand? And I thought, well, I know this one. But in 1 Samuel 20, David's in trouble. Well, he spent a lot of his young life in trouble, so that's not a surprise. But this is about David. Sorry, I'm having trouble turning pages here. And in chapter 20, no, it's chapter 19, I'm sorry. Chapter 19, David has fled to the prophet Samuel, to the judge Samuel, the prophet and judge, the man of God Samuel. And if you look in chapter 19 of 1 Samuel in verse 18, it says, when David had fled and made his escape and Saul was trying to kill him, I mean, he was certainly, he certainly had problems in his life that are much more terrible than many of the ones that we face right now. So he was running for his life, but he went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. So Samuel made a decision. He picked up and he and David went to a place called Naioth, N-A-I-O-T-H, which just means cabins. And apparently this Naioth was a place that Samuel had built as a place to train prophets, because there were prophets living there, and it was just a bunch of houses. It was dwelling places, but it was a safe place. It was a place where the Spirit of God was, and we'll see that in this story. And David was protected for a time, even though his enemy came there. It was so safe that there was safety there. And I like to think that the old man helped the young man physically, you know, fed him, gave him a place to sleep. And we know that they must have talked quite a bit, because by the time we get to the book of Chronicles, we see that David and Samuel had set up in detail all kinds of temple service, all kinds of who would be doing what and what the jobs would be. And this is the only time at Naioth, in this place of safety, this is the only time, extensive time, that Samuel and David spent together. So it was probably at this time that they did that kind of talking. Well, so he and Samuel went to Naioth and stayed there, and it was a haven and a sanctuary. Word came to Saul in verse 19, David is there. So he sent men to capture him, but Samuel brought out his people. And, you know, this reminds me of when in Worldwide, when Mr. Armstrong had three, we called them campuses, but they were places for people to live and learn and worship God and do music. We had one in England, we had one in Texas, we had one in Pasadena. And this was maybe not the same splendor, but it was the same idea that it would be a place to hide and train people and have them worship God. So he sent out his prophets. Now these prophets, it seems to be music that we're talking about. When he saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men and they also prophesied. So they're singing along. They can't not dance, you know, to the beat. It's really getting to them. And Saul was told about it, and you know, the men must have been embarrassed. So he sent more men, and the same thing happened. Samuel and his people came out, and that beat started, and the people had to sing along. They couldn't not do it. So finally, Saul did what people always do in that situation. He said, okay, I'll do it myself. And in verse 23, he went and said, where are Samuel and David? And they said, over in Naioth and Ramah. So Saul went to Naioth at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came even upon him. It was such a safe place that even David's enemy fell under the, can I call it spell, fell under the Spirit of God at that point. And he walked along prophesying until he came to Naioth. The whole way up to there, Saul is dancing and singing, and he just can't help himself. He stripped off his robes and also prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay that way all day and night. Now, you may think that he was safe because there wasn't YouTube in those days and there weren't cell phones, but the story definitely got around. And this is why in the last verse, it says, this is why people say, is Saul also among the prophets? Because he said, oh, I have to go take care of this. And he went. And he fell under the same spell. And the place was so safe that even when armed men came to get David, the Spirit of God protected it. And I just think that's wonderful. And you read later that this story stuck and haunted Saul for the rest of his life, that he couldn't get away from it. And at near the end of his life, a similar incident happened and they never let him forget it. It was part of the reason, you know, Saul's ratings went down the polls at that point. He was well below 30%, from what I understand. Well, of course, there were other safe places too. You remember that the prophet Elijah was in a safe place, that after Elijah had said that there will be no rain in the land, God said, well, now you need to go, because he was being chased. People wanted to kill him. Ahab and Jezebel wanted to kill him. So he had Elijah go to a place called the Brook Kerith, Cherith, Kerith. And this was where the ravens, and, you know, some people have tried to read other things into it, but it seems like it was birds, brought him food. And of course, there was water there. Eventually it dried up. But for a time being there, he had what Miss Whitting gave me at my house. Elijah had his own little safe hiding place from the world, and birds brought him food. Now, in some aspects, that's gross. But in other aspects, that's kind of cool. You know, and who knows what they brought him. But ravens are well known for being thieves, and I'm sure they could carry quite a bit in their beaks. So Elijah did all right. It was an interesting story to tell. And of course, you wonder, after that, he was sent to a widow's house. And this widow's house was also protected by God and made safe because it was a place of faith. God needed the widow to believe. And since she did believe, her jar of flour and her jug of olive oil never ran out for the entire famine. So while Elijah lived with her, he had food there. Eventually he had to leave. Now, you know the part about Elijah saying it wasn't going to rain, and people think, well, why did he do that? Well, you know, it's laid out in the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy is quite clear, and Deuteronomy is a fascinating book to read. You know, we regard it as the last chapter of the Pentateuch, the five books at the beginning, and it is, and it means second law, and the law is repeated in the book of Deuteronomy. And it talks about what people will do when they go into the land. And it retells the story of the Israelites from the time that they left Egypt, because it's a new generation of people. And Moses, who is still alive, and Joshua, who remembers this, they're telling the story for people. But there's another theme in Deuteronomy, which doesn't show up in the title. And that's that God, over and over again, a number of times says, when you come into the land, you be careful, because I'm going to give you a safe place. And let's look at it in Deuteronomy 11, but this is by no means the only place. It's in Deuteronomy 17, when he's talking about the king, and he says, when you come into the land. It's in Deuteronomy 18, when, you know, the blessings and curses, and it's in Deuteronomy 26, which is the beautiful part, you know, where he says, choose life at the end. But let's look at Deuteronomy 11, because that's one of the obvious first places where this comes up. Deuteronomy 11, verse 1, love the Lord your God and keep his requirements, his decrees, his laws, and his commands always. Remember today that your children were not the ones who saw and experienced the discipline of the Lord your God, his majesty, his mighty hand, his outstretched arms, and the things that he did. And of course, we'll be reading all those things prior to the Passover, because that's the story. Down in verse 8, Moses, speaking for God, says, observe therefore all the commands I am giving you today, so that you may have the strength to go in and take over the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, and so that you may live long in the land that the Lord swore to your forefathers to give them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. And then he goes on to describe how prosperous it is, how in Egypt had food, but Egypt had food because they took water from the Nile and dragged it to the food. They had, you know, irrigation. They had ways of doing it. But he pointed out that this is a land where it will rain. You won't have to do that. You just plow the earth to sow the seeds and stand back, because things will grow. And in verse 12, it says, it is a land the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are continually on it from beginning to end. Verse 13, so if you faithfully obey the commandments I am giving you today, to love the Lord your God, and notice that's the first commandment that he wants them to observe. It's not coveting. It's love the Lord your God. That's foremost, and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. So when Jesus echoed that later, he was referring to this kind of thing. And he says, then I will send rain. And then in the next verses, he says, but in verse 16, be careful, or you will be enticed to turn away and worship other gods and bow down to them. And then the Lord's anger will burn against you, and he will shut the heavens. And that's what he had Elijah do. See, we thought that God would do it himself, but he had a person do it. Well, God did it, but he had a person call it out and say it. So Elijah was following this kind of thing. And down in verse 22, it says, if you carefully observe all these commands I am giving you to follow, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways and to hold fast to him, we're seeing a pattern here, then the Lord will drive out nations. No man will be able to stand. Verse 26, see, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey, the curse if you disobey. And he was talking about how wonderful it would be. And talk, I mean, is that the definition of God giving someone a safe place? The eyes of the Lord your God are continually on it from the beginning of the year to the end. So that's what he was giving it. But he was saying, be careful, because safe places have their pitfalls. They have their problems. You can get so used to being safe that you can become complacent. And you can disobey me, and you think, well, nothing will happen, things are good. And he says that in Deuteronomy. He says, be careful that you don't fall into these things, that you're not seduced away from my way of life. And of course, most were seduced away, some were not, and it led to all kinds of things. But even in life outside God's word, safe places are quite a motif. They're a big part of our life. The womb is a safe place. And of course, sometimes things do go wrong in the womb, but for the most part, you know, it protects for 9 months. It gives a place of utter protection where the human being is fed and warm and taken care of and gets to hear the mother, you know, gets to hear her heartbeat, gets to hear her talk, gets to hear her sing. Towards the end of the 9 months, it must get a little crowded in there, but thankfully we don't remember it. Childhood, ideally, childhood is a guarded place. When it's not, we're horrified. When it turns out that childhood is a horrible place for some children, we are more horrified than if it happens with adults. But what we try to give our children is a place where they can grow up in relative safety. Now, of course, they have to understand how to live in the world, so we try to balance that. Every home that people have, we try to make it, you know, the phrase is a shelter from the storm. And homes, of course, are also places for hospitality and for letting people in. The Thomases are a wonderful example of that. From the day that they bought the place where they live now, they said, this is going to be a place where people can come and get together, God's family and our family, which for the Thomases is kind of the same thing. But it has been a place that we've all enjoyed. And so houses aren't just a shelter, but I know that the Thomases also appreciate the shelter aspect, and that Greg likes his garden, and that he likes to be away from the world and to escape to that part of things too. Schools are meant to be safe places. Let's not even talk about that, but they're meant to be. Universities are meant to be a safe simulation. They're not the real world. You go to a university and you learn. I remember when I was in forestry school, I looked at so many wildlife, you know, dead things, pelts and pickled in formaldehyde. And, you know, we learned animals a lot that way, but the best way to learn them was to go out in the world and just see them. But whether it's business, whether it's music, whether it's medicine, universities give us a safe simulation. We can practice in universities and not wreak havoc on the world. We train there. Or vocational schools the same way, or apprenticeships. It's given a safe place to learn before we go out in the world. Our church building is meant to be a safe place. And of course, it's meant to be a place where we welcome people in, but it's also meant to be a safe place, and we treat it that way. Our entertainment is often called escapism. Retirement is very much on my mind. I still work quite a bit in retirement, but one of the goals of retirement is safety, you know, is some margin of comfort that you have enough to get by, not necessarily millions and millions and millions of dollars, but enough to get by. That's a retirement goal, and we work for that all our life so that we can leave the cares behind. And Tay and I had the blessing of retiring about the time. She's been retired a little longer than I have, but we went into this COVID thing in retirement, which is a little less stressful. There's still quite a bit of stress involved, but it's a little easier for us because part of our life is defined by being in retirement. Even in the grave, you know, where safety is no longer needed, our tendency is to put people in beautiful boxes, cushioned boxes, safe places. And we put mementos in them, things that people would remember, even though they won't remember them. I guess maybe the thought is that when they're resurrected, they'll see these things. I don't know if that's it. And there's fantasies, of course, about going to the underworld and taking all these things with you for ancient kings and stuff. It doesn't apply to us very much. Not only do we put people in coffins, sometimes we put them in stone fortresses, you know, mausoleums to protect them. It's futile, but it's an impulse that we have. It's in our lives. Walking with God, being called by God and called to his way of life is a form of safety. Although he doesn't deliver us from the world, but at the same time, he does give us a respite from it. And that's part of what Jesus says. Let's turn to Matthew 11. Matthew 11, some of the most comforting verses you can find, where Jesus tells you what he's doing when he's calling people. In verse 28, of course, Jesus had 3 years worth of things to say on the subject, but in verse 28 of Matthew 11, he says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. So I will help you out of the world." Now, notice, though, that his next sentence puts that in a little bit of jeopardy, because he says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me." And a yoke makes you think that maybe it's not all rest, you know, that maybe there's things he wants you to do. But first, he calls you out of the world and gives you that kind of a respite. You know, many times, and of course, all of us in our human lives are subject to bereavement, we're subject to loss, we're subject to sickness. And of course, when we pray for our brothers and sisters, we pray for things like healing and that they would have their needs met and things like that. But one of the things that I often pray for, and I'm sure other people do too, is that God will give them a break, that God will just shelter them from the world and let them have the time and the mental de-stressing and whatever they need to recover from that kind of thing, to gain strength, because you don't do that right away. God doesn't say, "Be better," you know. Sometimes he has healed people miraculously and instantly, but at the same time, it takes a while for people to recover. We know that that's not instant. And sometimes people never do recover from things. That's what PTSD is, where they're triggered by things. But one of the things that I pray for is that God will give them a place in the world where they won't be subject to these things, and where they will have, you know, like being in a greenhouse, that they will have the things that they need and that they can grow and regain a form of strength. And that's what happened to Taya and me when we moved to Cleveland East. We were struggling, and we were given that kind of safe place. And we, like I said, we will always appreciate it. One of the things that he gave Adam and Eve, speaking of safety, is in the form of a weekly piece of theater. And when I say theater, I use that term because in a way we're acting it out. It's not real. The Sabbath is real in that it comes every 7 days and it starts at sunset and ends the following sunset. But the things that the Sabbath is about are theater. They're in our minds. And one of the things that we have to do is remember the Sabbath. That's the way God says it, which means get your mind in Sabbath gear once a week. And it's a place of safety. You know, I talked about my place on the couch and Miss Whitting's lamp and things like that. And that's one form, but we all have our way of doing it. It's a safety that looks backward to when God created the earth. And it's a safety that looks forward to when God will return and give the world rest. So safety is a huge driving force in our lives. You know, we choose neighborhoods for safety. We long for a better time. It shows up, you know, a lot of what's at root in political strife is people wanting to preserve good things. Now, sometimes the strife is between preserving their own good things at the expense of others' good things, or do we want to spend the money and have these good things for everybody? And I, you know, I don't want to get into that. But a lot of it, I think, has to do with longing for a better time. When you see what drives people in their hearts, it's sometimes a little different from what's on the surface. And usually I would say to you that they're looking for a certain safety, whether it's economic or safety from crime or safety from illness. That's what people are looking for. It's often in the past. It's often looking backward. Jesus himself had this kind of urge built into him. And I believe that God gave him that. You know, well, I mean, he gave it to all human beings, so Jesus would have had it. But, you know, he was, up until the time when he was baptized, he was seeking his Father. He was trying to understand things. And when God put him on the earth, there was a risk. I mean, you could say there was no risk because he had God's Holy Spirit and he would always obey. But there is a risk. And Satan knew there was a risk. That's why he could tempt him. Now, Jesus rose above that, thankfully. To our eternal gratitude, he rose above that. But still, there was that drive in him, even as a little boy. And he knew things were a little strange. I mean, the story of his parentage was unusual, and his mother must have told him things. And there were stories that the neighborhood knew, you know, that the family had disappeared to Egypt for a while, and that strange men had come and visited them. And even the night that he was born, there were unusual things. But Jesus had it built into him, even as a child, to seek his Father. And that's why he ended up in the safest place of all that God had given them, which was a temple when he was 12. We call it a temple. God refers to it as a house. It was the house of his Father. You know, it's something that God has given us to various civilizations as a symbol on earth. Eventually, of course, God's house is both literal, like the kind of kingdom that Mr. Thomas was talking about recently, but it's also a place of your, in your mind, you know, that God's house is the household of God. It's our village. It's the family of God. And so, you know, it's very clear that this desire inside us is something that, well, I do want to mention that Jesus left the safest place of all. You know, he was living in a different world with his Father, and he left that to come here to accomplish specific things for our benefit, but also for his and his Father's benefit. It was worth it to him. It was worth it. You know, he spent eternity in a safe place, but then he chose to leave it. And that's the other aspect to safety that we need to think about, because even the Sabbath has two elements. There's that wonderful Friday night. You know, I've often said, I wish Friday nights were always in winter, and I wish Saturday nights were always in summer, meaning that the Sabbath would start early and end late. But there's two aspects to the Sabbath, and it's kind of fun that God gave it to us from sunset to sunset. I mean, that's a day for him, so it wasn't a question of it. But first we start off with Friday night, and then we sleep. We have this place of rest, and then we really rest. We sleep, ideally. And then we have the seventh day. I mean, I'll call it Saturday. That's not what God calls it, but to distinguish it from Friday night. And what we do on Saturday is we go out. No, I didn't have to today. I'm technologically going out. But we go out and we go into the community and we go to our place and we gather together and we worship God. So first we retreat, but then part of Sabbath is going out and we assemble. We make that effort. There's Friday and there's Saturday. God tells us as part of his calling, even though he says, I will give you rest, what's the last instructions he gives us? To go into the world. That we have our safety and we can retreat into it when we need it. But there are times when we have to leave it behind. And that's part of God's plan too. And we have to appreciate both of them. Now, we have an end time mythology, and when I say mythology, it's real, but I say mythology because myths can be real, but there's a certain mythical quality to these end time things because we get them out of the book of Revelation, which is, you know, it's a vision, and it has some things in it that are very strange, and these end time things that we know about, I call them mythology because they color our thoughts in so many different ways. And they have the aspect of saga and legend to them. They're that built into it. But two of the things that we believe are still to be in the future are a safe place. And this is in the book of Revelation and other places. And people make, you know, in our church, we just drop this all the time. So other people don't know what we're talking about all the time. But we talk about a safe place from the book of Revelation where some of God's people will be sheltered for 3.5 years. The Bible's that specific. Very, very unspecific about most of the details, but that one is specific about. And that this will be before Jesus returns. But we also have another element that's related in our end time mythology, our end time story. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. And that is the two witnesses. The two witnesses I'm not going to get into right now, but they're God's final way of taking his message to the world. And it seems that they are both rooted, when you read about them in Zechariah, that they are rooted in the safe place. That they have their life and their being and their, they get their energy from the safe place, but they leave it. And it says, God will bless your going out and your coming in. And we know that when we finally die, they're not in their safe place anymore. They're out in the world doing the things that they need to do, that God will instruct them to do. So there's the safety, and then there's the leaving of it to go out and do God's work that Mr. Mango was talking about, and Glenn talked about recently. You know, it's heart and soul of our way of life. We have to do God's work. You know, we regard Eden as a tragedy and a flop. And it's certainly not a comedy, although there are funny parts of it. With Adam and Eve were, like I said, they were adults, but they were children. And so some of the things that they did, God must have gone, isn't that cute? Just like we do with little children today. But we regard it as a tragedy. The world uses the word fall. I know we've been admonished not to use that word, but something happened and God took them from the safe place and cast them out. But you notice some things in that story, and it's in Genesis 3, and you know it well, and we don't have time to go into it in detail right now. But God, although he curses them, and by curses them, I guess it's better to say he punishes them. He inflicts certain things on them. He's actually rather tender to Adam and Eve. And after he casts them out, even though he's made in no uncertain terms that it was their fault. And you know, this is after he's come to visit them. He's left his safe world and he's come to see Adam and Eve because he loves Adam and Eve and they're a huge part of his plan. And that's why he's there in the garden and he finds out that these things have happened. And so there is some anger and there is punishment, but at the end, he rather tenderly clothes them because they're upset. They don't have to be clothed. There's nothing wrong with them not being clothed. But they're worried about being clothed at that point. It's part of what the serpent has done to them and a part of what partaking the fruit has let their thinking lead to. It didn't cause it, but it let it lead to. And so God very tenderly takes care of them at that point. How would you like to have garments that God made? I wish I could get a bathrobe that fits right. You know, I just never seem to be able to. I find bathrobes. Well, these clothes fit Adam and Eve pretty well. God made them. And so we know that they were good. But at the same time, you know, tragedy. Bad things happened in Eden. And yet, I wonder if that's the way that God looks at it. That because you read what God has done and the way that he proceeds after that, and he stuck around, by the way. He didn't leave right away. They were cast out of the garden and prohibited from entering again. But it said they could, you know, that God was still around. Cain and Abel could find him. It wasn't till later that people had to call on the name of God. So it sounds like God, well, it's not sounds like, I mean, you have to believe that God always had this extra plan. For when, not if Adam and Eve misbehaved, but when they did. And he expected them, that this was part of something that they had discussed and he had a way of operating. So from God's way of thinking, was it a tragedy? Is it a tragedy if he ends up with more and better children who have had to live outside the place of safety and that's how they grow to become like God? That maybe the family of God couldn't be birthed in Eden as well as it could. And there's a phrase that the poet William Blake uses, and it has to do a lot with the Industrial Revolution in England, but it's a very colorful phrase. And it's in a very well-known English hymn that they sing at coronations, that they sang at the royal weddings and things like that. And people just sing the words. And do they think about them? Well, it talks about mankind growing in the dark satanic mills. And that's the exact words that are in that hymn. It's not scripture. But that's the point, is that we live in this evil world and that we grow to be like God and that there are good things about it. And that's why God takes the time to help us and give us these safe places, places that we can duck into when we need to, and then go out in the world and become more like God and help other people become more like God. You know, so many of the people of God had to go through terrible things. It says God walked with Enoch, but in the end, Enoch died. Now, God did something special at that time, and we're not exactly sure what it was, but many of the prophets were tortured. In the book of Hebrews, it talks about some were sawn in two, some were killed, you know, that they had their safe places, but God, in the end, will bring them to a safe place. But in the meantime, they suffered the slings and arrows of the world. God tells us in Matthew 5, I think you're in Matthew at this point, so it's not too hard to go over to Matthew 5, and in verse 14, he talks about you're the salt of the earth. And then verse 14, he says, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. And I have to say that even though the quilt I have is a very fine quilt, and I love my quilt, that there's no way me with my quilt over my head is going to be a light to the world. So I can enjoy my quilt over my head and not being part of the world, but I still have to do this. And Mr. Kubik was talking about that in the message that Greg read today. We have to be the light of the world. So, you know, not so much anymore. My Friday night pageant has changed quite a bit. I no longer have this lamp. Tay and I often sit together in the living room and the dog is with us and we close the curtains. That's a big part of leaving the world behind. Tay often lights candles and has a special meal. And we have our Friday night safe place. Miss Whitting helped me set it up in the beginning. We're in dark times now, and I'm not talking about dark times like tribulation before Jesus returns. I'm talking about 2020 and, you know, now wanting to leave this pandemic behind us and go back to life the way we enjoyed it. And at some point, they will end. We don't see how the end will come at this point, but all those things end. The Spanish flu ended. It took two years, but it ended. And at that point, we'll be able to crawl out of our safe spaces. There's much to be done before Jesus returns. And God gives us instructions that we have to go to all the world. We have to appreciate the safety and shelter and sanctuary that God gives us. But we also need to be willing to leave our safe place behind. And we need to do it wittingly,